to share some of that information with our Keelan, with our community, and very much looking forward to Rabbi Gross's presentation. So without further ado, please, Rabbi Gross.
Okay. Good evening. So I thank you, Rabbi Bienfeld, for the opportunity. I wrote down a bunch of stuff that he can mention. I guess the assignment is what goes on in a restaurant in the back end. What is a hashgacha actually checking? What are we looking for? How do we know when we go other places? What can we trust? What can't we trust? So I put down a bunch of topics, and maybe why would a certain place qualify for a certain hashgacha and another place would not, and how do we know? Now I am I think this is an open. This could be an open conversation. I think probably best to ask clarification questions as we go along. Certainly at the end, I'm happy to take questions, and certainly I'm willing to discuss. Feel free to reach out to me in many different ways either way. Thank you to the Cherry Hill community. I see a couple of local members on the Wynwood side as well, as perhaps even some people that are outside of the area. And here we go. So, just in terms of where does one open up if one wanted to be, let's say, I don't know, a kashrus administrator? So, what area of Shulchan Aruch should a person concentrate on the most? What is the area that we think about? Oh, well, that if you want to work in the area of kashrus, then that's the area of halacha that you need to know the best. So, I think the quick answer is, I have the chat box open. If anybody wants to ask questions that way or make comments along the way, so please maybe take advantage of that. That might be the best way of doing this. So I think who can see your messages? Oh, okay. So I think the ideal, the typical answer that person would give is, well, you got to learn the laws of kashrus, which is we normally assume to be probably the second half of the first section of Yoredeia. The lachas dealing with the laws of Basar V'Chalav and the laws of Taruvas, various mixtures that come into play. Well, you better know that if you're going to be in the realm of kashrus. So I would tell you that I think now that I've been an administrator for about a year and a half, questions in that area of Shulchan Aruch have been pretty far, few and far between. And the reason for that is that almost that entire section of Shulchan Aruch, those 20 chapters or so, are mostly dealing with what happens when you've messed up. I mean, what happens when there's a drip that goes someplace? What happens if something goes flying across the room? What happens if you made a mistake about what kind of pot you were using? Those kinds of things. And So those are all the questions that when you set up a restaurant or when you're setting up any type of food establishment, from a kashrus perspective, from a kashrus organization perspective, you are attempting to avoid all of those questions. I mean, those are all, if the system breaks down, that's something that that takes place. The area of halachos that I've probably had to work on the most or open up sources for the most are sort of areas revolving around the world of the actual food. So, for example, the halachos of Bishul Akum, about non-Jews cooking food. What can we do and what can't we do? Pasakum, the laws of Yashan, the laws of, well, Shemitah questions have started to come in that we need to work on. And then another area that a kashrus administrator, which I guess is not so much the topic tonight, but the area of Hilchus Shabbos. Shabbos caterers trying to work out what the halachos are for running an event over Shabbos. So that's something that also requires a significant amount of thought. So I will, I guess, run through. So let's take it as a given that in a food establishment, a restaurant, we're going to take it as a given, although it's not completely a given, that it's either going to be milk or it's going to be fleishik. That's a given for tonight. We're not going to worry about milk and meat mixing together. That's assumed that that's not something that's going to take place. So now you walk into a restaurant, and what are some of the other issues that I want to have my eye on, either that the as a consumer, I just need to be educated about this. So that's actually the place that we're one example that we're going to start with pretty close to the beginning. And and maybe what's going on behind the scenes in order to resolve that issue, if it's being resolved. Maybe that's something I should ask, if it actually is being resolved. So the first thing that people think of right away is, what's the halachos of Bishul Akum? So Bishul Akum is that there is a prohibition totally in force today that anything that is cooked by a non-Jew is something that we're not going to be permitted to eat. However, there are a couple of significant exceptions to that rule, which very much come into play when we talk about kashering a kosher restaurant establishment. So the two main exceptions to that is that the food has to be what we call ro'i l'shulchan malachim, which is a little bit difficult to, literally means fit for a king's table. There's somewhat of a dispute out there, about what exactly that means. I mean, does it have to be fit for a royal banquet, a presidential dinner, a wedding, a bar mitzvah, a bris, a shalom zachari? What exactly qualifies as being fit for a king's table? We'll assume there has to be a pretty formal food. So that actually excludes a bunch of foods that perhaps we'd be used to in restaurants. So, for example, we're talking to the Cherry Hill community tonight. So a question came up with regards to Maya's Meals, the falafel bar there. So the truth is, everything there is, there's no Bishul Akum issues there. But I remember when we were discussing about this, some of the Rabbanim pointed out, said, hey, wait a second, is falafel really something that qualifies as Bishul Akum anyways? Meaning, is that really something that we would call Roy L'Shulchan Malachim? Now, it is set up, actually, this is before I got involved, Rabbi Bienfeld played a major role in making sure that place was set up in a way that the issue would be able to be would be able to be avoided. So that's one thing. It has to be a impressive food. And the other thing is that it has to not be able to be eaten raw. If that food can be eaten raw, so then the prohibition of Bishul Akum is not going to apply. So, for example, a vegan restaurant. So immediately the quick answer with people ask, hey, can I eat in any vegan restaurant? Obviously, all the food there is going to be kosher. Well, it's not so obvious that all the food there is going to be kosher. But one of the immediate answers, yeah, well, how do you resolve Bishul Akum if it's a non-kosher restaurant, even if it's a restaurant that's owned by non-Jews? So isn't the food going to be considered Bishul Akum? So that is a significant concern. However, I would just point out a lot of like vegan foods, the food that they actually use to fake out, so to speak, like the fake chicken that they use. If it's a chicken dish at a vegan restaurant, they're often using mushrooms. And those mushrooms actually could be eaten raw. So that's something just to consider when we go into these kinds of restaurants. Is it something that is subject to Bishul Akum? Of course, in most of these restaurants, in 99% of the kosher restaurants that you go to, they are relying on the idea of pilot lights. That as long as a Jew was a Shomer Shabbos Jew was involved in the lighting of the fire, and the fire originally emanates from a Shomer Shabbos Jew, so then you're good to go. So if there is a pilot, and most, Baruch Hashem, most commercial ovens and stoves are still using pilot lights, a lot of home ones are not anymore, but commercial ones are. So as long as there is a light there that was once lit by a Shomer Shabbos Jew, that's going to continue on pretty much ad infinitum. Now, one of the things that a mashgiach is going to check, if it's not a regular mashgiach, well, one of the things that everybody knows is that the mashgiach has to be the one to light the thing. So if it's a place, the fire. So if it's a place where there's what we call a mashgiach tamidi, that there's a regular mashgiach that's going to be there at all times, or 99.5% of the time, so all of the people in the kitchen know the rabbi's the one who's going to touch the fire, so who's going to be the ones to handle the fire. And when you go to a place like Cherry Grill, or a place like the tavern just came under our Ashgacha once again, or Judah's Grill, those kinds of places. So there's a Mashkiach Tmidi there. The first thing the Mashkiach does when he gets there in the morning is that he goes and makes sure all the fires are on. Either if there's a pilot light, that the pilot light is still going, or that the oven, if the oven does not have a pilot light, that he's the one who's going to turn on the oven. If there's rice cookers, or if there's some of the like panini makers, all these types of things, he's going to plug in, make sure that it already has reached a requisite amount of heat, and that's something that the Mashkiach is going to be in charge of keeping an eye on. If it's a place that does not have a Mashkiach Tamidi, that's only going to be there somebody coming, rarely is there going to be a restaurant that's going to have somebody coming in less than once or twice a week, but that's something that the Mashkiach is going to be regularly checking, making sure that fire is still on, and every once in a while turning it off and turning it on. Also in these a place like that, there is going to be some type of assurance that it didn't go on and off when you weren't there. So there's sealing mechanisms that you'll do that'll make it impossible for the pilot light to be turned on without the mashgiach or administrator or whatever knowing that something was worked around with regards to that light. So that is the basic Bishul Akum issue. I will just throw in one more thing if we have any Svardim here on the call. Svardim actually would not rely on a pilot light situation for their laws of Bishul Akum. Svardim have a higher standard of what they refer to as Bishul Yisrael, that they refer that a Jew actually be involved in the actual cooking process. So there are very few restaurants that fall under this this realm of this level of hashgacha. Because it's very hard to do. I mean, that means that a Jew really has to be involved in all of the cooking. We happen to have, Judah's Grill happens to have that chumrah. So it came to us from a Sephardic Rav, who was overseeing it for a while. It's a Sephardic community. And they decide that we're going to maintain that high standard of Bishul Akum Lefi Chumrat Beit Yosef. I think that's how we refer to it, according to the stringency of the Beit Yosef. And there really is a Mashgiach that is standing right next to the grill at all times, making sure any food that goes on that grill, the Mashgiach is the one who is putting it on. Sometimes a Sephardi might come to a restaurant and say, and call over the Mashgiach and say, hey, can you make sure to put the food on? Meaning he wants to fulfill that stringency. So we'll call over say the Mashgiach, I want to order, I'm ordering chicken. Can you make sure that order you put on the grill rather than just than the cook? So that's often the Mashgiach will attempt to make that accommodation for that person. Although it could point out that often it doesn't work. So, if, for example, a place like Cherry Grill, Cherry Grill, when it's not busy, so all right, you can start, you can do whatever you want. The Mashgiach will do whatever you want. You might just wait longer for your food. But when things are busy, so for instance, the chicken, if you order General Tso's chicken, so the chicken was already made beforehand, meaning they usually make the chicken first, so it's already cooked, and then they'll put it in later, they'll fry it in the sauce later on once the order comes in. So if a Sephardi comes in and says, hey, can you put the chicken on, it's not really going to work in that scenario because the chicken is already made. So that's something that Sephardim have to consider. Different Sephardim have different opinions on it. I've seen that Rav Avadya Yosef himself in America would eat in Ashkenazi restaurants, saying that that's the minug of the land, and therefore we don't have to be machmir on it. But different Sephardim will try to deal with that in their own ways. Okay, so that I think covers much of the Bishul Akum discussion. The next issue, and this truth is with regard from what I've seen in meat restaurants, this area causes me the most amount of anxiety, and to the point that I'm even surprised that it is common across the land that this is in all restaurants, but all hashkachos, as far as I know, do allow this, and that is to have fish and meat both being served in the same restaurant. There is a halacha, there is based on a gemara. It's not really a kashrus issue in particular per se, but for all intents and purposes, it has the kashrus connotation that fish and meat should not be eaten together. The Gemara seems to assume that it's some kind of danger involved as opposed to a halacha, but either way, it's in Shulchan Aruch that we don't eat fish and meat together. So in our homes, so especially on Shabbos, you might have a fish course, and then you'll have a meat course, and the plate will be taken away, and the utensils will be taken away, or they'll be cleaned, or whatever, and therefore one's not going to have a issue there. In a restaurant, it becomes a little bit more complicated, just because who exactly is monitoring what's going to whom? And I think the most complicated issue is, who's keeping track of exactly what is fleishiks? So if a person orders a meal of fish, and then they order a side of French fries and grilled vegetables, so you all look at that and say, well, you're having fish and you're having parv, right? You're having things that aren't meat. So how's the fish and meat mix being, right? That seems like that should be pretty simple. Except it's not, because probably in many fleishik restaurants, it's going to depend on the place whether this is the fact. But in many places, the the French fries are actually 100% Flachics. So one example of a Cherry Grill. Cherry Grill has one fryer, right? That fryer is used for chicken, and then the chicken is fried there. And then later on in the day, and then after that, they put French fries in there, and they don't change the oil. Meaning what? That is the halachic equivalent, then, of cooking French fries in chicken soup, which means that those French fries are 100% wait 6 hours Flachics. They're fully Flachics. So to have those French fries together with fish is a problem. Beyond that, grilled vegetables as well. So where are they grilling the vegetables? So they're grilling it on the grill. Right, so if they're grilling it on the grill, I'm not sure they have the Cherry Grill, but at one of our other places, so though that if they're grilling it with meat or after putting meat there, so that those grilled vegetables are considered to be Flachic. Again, like wait 6 hours afterwards Flachic. So what some places do is they grill the vegetables earlier in the day and then we'll only heat them up later. I mean, the first thing they'll do is grill the vegetables when the grill is still clean, therefore they would still be not par, but they'll be meat equipment, and then later on they'll heat it up later in the day. But it is important for the customer to realize that some of that food that is coming out of the kitchen, while it might appear parv, and it may, you know, the package that it came in may say parv, it actually might be Flachic based on the way that they were preparing it. So when we started giving the hechsher to Cherry Grill, so we had them put on the menu that everything that is prepared in the kitchen should be considered meat. I forgot the exact language that we use, but should be considered meat. I remember telling them maybe you want to like put a nice sticker on or something. He said, nah, they took out a pen and just wrote it on all the menus. So if you look at the front page of the menus, it has some language along those lines to try to alleviate that issue. And then I think probably the third most common. Oh, does meat apply equally to red meat and chicken? So, yeah, I think for all intents and purposes, we assume it does. First of all, practically, chicken and meat, they both might be in that same place, and that halacha would apply with chicken as well. Practically speaking. I would just add, not all restaurants are the same as Cherry Grill. Some of them actually have separate deep fryers for instance, Judah's Grill in the Northeast, so their deep fryer is only used for parv, only used for French fries there. So French fries from there would be parv, while French fries from Cherry Grill would be Flachic. It's going to depend on the place, and that's something you could ask the Mishkiach when there, what exactly is the situation with regards to that food. They try to warn things. And by the way, another thing that we have to worry about is, so what if a person orders French fries and fish? So it says on the menu that the fries are Flachic. So at what so you tell the person, listen, you know the French fries are meat. The person says, what are you talking about? I don't care. That's not something that I worry about. So how much responsibility does A, the restaurant, B, the mashkiach, C, the waiter, or D, the kashrus agency have to make sure not just that people are able to keep halacha in the room, but that they have to keep halacha in the room, right? Do we permit the restaurant to serve the person, for instance, French fries and fish, knowing that they're going to eat them together against this halacha? So the general approach is yes. I mean, once the food goes to the plate, you know, as long as the person knows what's going on, we will tell them, you know, you notice this point, or, you know, sometimes it's hard for the waiter, not necessarily, but it is clear on the menu what the story is. So beyond that point, we're not going, you know, if one person on one side of the table orders a hamburger and the person on the other side of the table orders fish, we're not going to monitor to make sure that they don't share each other's food. Like, that's just not something that we're able to keep track of. Would takeout be different? What do you mean, would takeout be different? You could either say it or... going once, going twice. I see. Would takeout be different? I don't think if you're taking out. then. Okay, we'll come back to it. I'm not sure what the question is, but generally the take.
The question is, if you're doing takeout, okay, you're doing takeout, and it's one thing to do that in the restaurant itself. Takeout may have five different people eating.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody else is eating fish, somebody else is eating meat. So it's not on the same plate, but you don't. So I'm wondering if you would be less stringent with takeout than you would be for eat in.
Well, even eat in, we're not going to force people to stay apart. We just want to make sure that the information is out there and people are able to access it and see it. The general rule that I try to use, and people have asked me this question, we're not really covering tonight the issue of chumras, meaning as an institution, do we require Pas Yisrael, do we require Chalav Yisrael, what exactly do you require in terms of those realms of stringencies? So what I tell people is the most important chumra that we have is that we tell the truth, is that what it says on our tuda, what it says on our certificate, is actually what's going on in the restaurant. And then people make their own decisions as to what they're going to partake of and what they're not. So really the same thing is going to be with regards to this issue that we just talked about, the fish and meat. The most important thing is that people have access to the information, and you know, and it's out there, and they'll have access, and they'll see it, and it's understandable, and they can recognize what the issues are, and then what they decide to do is already really beyond our control. We're not going to take responsibility on that. I was just listening recently that Rav Moshe, I didn't look it up inside, but I just heard it in Ishir, that Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about some place, I think it was in Mexico, if I'm not confusing things, that they wanted to know about having a some kind of, not really a restaurant, some kind of place that was going to serve kosher food, and they were going to have milchiks and fleishiks in the same place, and knowing that probably many of the people there aren't religious and were going to mix them together. They were going to have meat, and right away afterwards was going to have, you know, go across the hall and was going to have ice cream someplace else. So is that a problem of lishna yivir? Is that a problem of sort of putting a stumbling block in front of people? And Rav Moshe said, no, you know, that's not your responsibility. Your responsibility is what goes on behind the counter. Probably make sure that people know, and what people then decide to do is already out of your hands, at least as a kashrus organization. I guess the final main thing that is sort of everybody wonders, like your immediate questions you have when discussing a restaurant, is what's the story with checking for bugs in terms of in vegetables and leafy vegetables? How do we ensure that takes place? And that's going to have in fact, that's a significant portion of the Mashiach's job, is checking the vegetables, all of the different vegetables for bugs. They have their processes that they have to take. Generally speaking, it needs to be at least checked by a Shomer Shabbos Jew, by the Mashkiach, or establishment owner, if they happen to fit into that category. And that's like a major issue of what's going on behind the scenes, to make sure that all the vegetables are cleaned and checked appropriately. I think maybe we could do that in another discussion. We could have a whole bug checking hour devoted to that, but just putting it out there as another topic. And then along the lines of, again, a restaurant consideration, so any time that a person, you know, the immediate assessment that you have to make is how much hashkacha does this place need? And that is going to have different levels, and that's also somewhat community driven based on really what's possible. So there's a couple of different forms of that could take place. Number one would be just, well, the owner itself saying, you know, this is my restaurant, come and eat here, I'm, you know, if you trust me, great, if you don't. So is that acceptable? You might just not be under a kashrus agency at all. So people say, oh, the laws of kashrus agencies isn't found in Shulchan Aruch. I don't know. This happens to be an explicit halacha in Shulchan Aruch. It's in Kuf Yud Tes Sif Aleph. So the Mechaber there discusses if you don't have any doubts about that person, you could trust whatever he says about kashrus. And the Rama makes a comment that says, no, nowadays we don't allow on an institutional level a person to be able to, we don't just trust any person on an individual level, they have to be vouched for by a Rav, by the Rav Ha'ir, something like that. And that's something that perhaps has developed a little bit, but the Rama does mention it over there. In other areas of halacha as well, other areas of kashrus, so for example, shchita. So shchita is, it's not just, oh, there's a person who says they know shchita, so therefore we're going to trust everything that they do. No, there's a tradition that the Rav of the city oversees the shchita. In fact, that was when a Rav came to town, that was like the ceremony of appointing him as the Rav of the city, is that all the shochtim in town would present their knives to the Rav, and he would check all their knives on behalf of that person. So just a person saying, hi, I'm Orthodox, and and just trust me. So that's really not a significant, that doesn't really work bizman hazeh, certainly not on an institutional level. So then there's really two forms of hashkacha, but there is certainly gray areas in between, and that is, one is either have a mashkiach tamidis, meaning having somebody who's going to be constantly there, meaning the store cannot be operational without having a mashkiach there, meaning they often, some of our places we require, some of them they don't, but the mashkiach might be the only one with a key, or might be the only one with the key to the fridge or the freezer, or the stove stove is impossible to start without a mashkiach being present. So that's something that sometimes happens. And then the other possibility is what we call yotzei v'nichnas, that a person is coming in and going out, the hashkacha is really that whoever is owning and running the store is nervous that, hey, this guy could pop in at any possible time. The rabbi could show up any time, and he's got to be able to have access. In fact, that's one of the rules. It's in our contracts that the rabbi and the kashrus administrator can come into your place at any time that they want. We're not going to be limited. And we're going to see what's going on there. And if we catch anything is amiss, so then that's going to be obviously a problem. Now, some places are going to require, when you're on this yotzi v'nichnas, so there are things that al pi halacha require a mashkiach tamidus. So number one is meat. Right, so there is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch called Basar Shenisali Mina Ayin, that if meat has left the purview, has left the eye of a Jew, so then we have to assume that a non-Jew may have switched that meat with something else. Now, it doesn't mean you have to have your eyes on your freezer the entire time, right? If it's in your house and it's locked up, so you don't have to worry about it. Or if it's in a restaurant and it's locked up, so it's locked up. That's not something that you have to be concerned about. But usually, when a restaurant is in operation, the freezer is not locked up, and it's not like the Mashkiach is standing right in front of the freezer at all times, monitoring exactly what's going in and what's going out of that freezer. So there are other controls that we have in place in a restaurant. For example, there's usually there's a front door and there's a back door. Maybe there's two back doors, but really all deliveries have to be checked off by the Mashkiach. Another thing is that often meat comes in, so meat is in a package. So when it's in that package, so that package means that it's sealed. You can't just fix. You can't just replace one thing with another thing. So if it's sealed, so then that's considered to be certainly a good hashgacha. So really, the eyes of the Mashkiach is on that meat once the package has been opened. We have in one of our supermarkets here, this came up actually last week, and that is the procedure that we get when we get when meat, kind of like those big sides of meat that get cut up into the meat you put in your chilant. So that comes in pretty big packages, and there's usually about four or five of them in a box. So there's four or five of these pieces of meat. All of them are individually sealed. They all have a sticker, or they're all supposed to have a sticker on it with a hashkacha on it. Usually it's meat, so there's usually two or three or four hashkachas on it. And all of that is wonderful. So we have the box, so in a supermarket, the box comes in, the non-Jew goes and opens up the box, takes the meat with the packages on it, and there's still a sticker on it, so everything is still sealed. And then he he only opens those packages in the room where he cuts it up after it's been checked by a mashgiach. So he's going to wheel this thing in with 10 big pieces of meat on it. The mashgiach will check to make sure there's a sticker and a seal on every single one, and then he brings it into the room and he does the work that he needs to do. But already at that point he's in the kosher area, and there's really nothing else that's going to be coming in and out of the kosher area. So what happens if those packages don't have a sticker on it? So the policy had been, the non-Jewish butcher there, who at this point might know the laws of kashrus better than some of the mashgichim, but the non-Jewish butcher, so he says, it doesn't have a sticker on it, we're going to send it back. Now, under normal circumstances, it's not a big deal to just send it back, because there's deliveries coming, 2 or 3 times a week. It's just put in the freezer, it's sent back, and they do whatever they do with it. That's no longer our concern. But all of a sudden, the last couple of weeks, there's been a meat shortage. So we'll send it back, and they'll give us our money back, but there's no guarantee that there's going to be enough meat to go around. So the question came up, can we change our procedure somewhat for this? So, meaning it's coming in a sealed box, and inside, so why do they have those separate seals? Why do they have a seal? Why is the meat sealed if it's coming in a sealed box? So the answer is, specifically for this reason. That way the non-Jew can open up the box, and all the meat will remain sealed inside. But if the meat does not, if it happens to not have a sticker on it, then we got a problem, right? We don't have any, the only indication that we have that the meat was fine is that it came in the sealed box. But once the non-Jew broke that seal, so he could theoretically take that meat that's in there, go to the shelf, and take some non-kosher meat off the shelf and just put it in, right? So that's a concern that we have. So the truth is, there's video cameras and all that kind of stuff. But still, generally, kashrus agencies don't rely specifically on video cameras for the simple reason that nobody's really watching a video camera at all times. You might be able to go back and check a video camera if there's something that looks amiss, but no one's watching a video camera to make sure that it's okay.
Hi, Ricky. You're not supposed to be here.
Sorry, I thought the door was locked. So we changed the procedure to be is that instead of him opening the box on his own, now every time he opens the box, he's going to have a mashgiach next to him when he opens the box. And that way, all the packages of meat that come out, whether they have a sticker on or whether they don't have a sticker on it, the mashgiach will see, he'll label, he'll stamp, and at that point, rather than wait till it comes up to the kosher area, and that way we won't have to send any of the meat back if there happens not to be a sticker seal on one of those packages. Okay, so that's just something going on. Some other things just to think about kashrus agency has to keep an eye on, and this takes some competence to really be on top of. So number one, produce that comes from Israel. So this year in particular is a Shemitah year. The official policy of most kashrus organizations, and not just, we'll get into what ACCO is a little bit later, but officially the standard approach that kashrus agencies in America have is not to rely on the Heter Mechira. We can assume that's a good idea, we can assume it's a bad idea, but that's just what it is. You can't fight City Hall when it comes to that. So you have to monitor if there's produce coming from Israel. So it has to, this year in particular, it has to be under a hashkacha and a hashkacha that is not going to rely on the Heter Mechira. Beyond that, on a regular year, you have to keep track of Truma and Meiser and those things. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be purchasing produce, or our institutions shouldn't be purchasing produce that comes from Israel, but you have to monitor to make sure that if it is coming from Israel, that the appropriate actions are taken to make sure that it can be sold. Challah, separating challah is a concern. It's something that also you got to keep there are some sort of shortcuts that are used in industrial settings to sort of remove it, to remove it from something that the people on the ground have to deal with on a constant basis. For another time, resolving challah in industrial and commercial settings, talk about that another time, but that is certainly something that you need to keep in mind. And then there's always specific issues that require a specific amount of expertise, or sometimes the illusion of expertise. So for example, Shechita, Keystone K is not going to be overseeing a Shechita operation anytime soon, right? We're not going to be giving license to Shochtim. It's certainly something that I don't have the stomach for, and I don't think that we're that's really something in the domain of sort of the of specific Heksherim. Malicha. Assaulting. So assaulting is also something that has really been removed. That's not something that we worry about. That, with the exception of livers. So Judah's Grill, for example, does have a dish liver. They do have liver that comes in and requires koshering. Now, it sounded, I remember when they first told me this, I sounded like, well, how are we going to deal with that? But the truth is, there's a procedure. I mean, once you put a procedure in place and the Mashgiach is there at all times, the Mashgiach will oversee to make sure that the liver is cut and roasted as it's supposed to be. And then there's wine. That's another thing that a mashgiach has to keep his eye on, especially because restaurants will allow people to bring their own wine. They'll have to make sure to bring their own wine, but that's something the mashgiach will have to stay up on. In fact, the mashgichim in restaurants are supposed to leave the back. Probably tell them, you know, at least, you know, 5-10 minutes every hour at least should be spent on the floor, keeping an eye to make sure that people didn't bring food from the outside, that wine is all mevushal, if they brought any type of other liquors and drinks like that, that's under control and under, you know, that's appropriate. And so that's another part of the job of the mashgiach. I see it's asked about Orlin Chutzlaritz. So Orlin Chutzlaritz is an issue. I mean, you have to worry, even fruits that grow in outside of Israel, if it's within the first 3 years, so there is a halacha of orla with it, but there are actually lists out there about how, you know, what type of produce can get out when, and there also is the general suffik orla b'chutz la'aretz, that if there's a question about orla outside of Israel, so we have the right to be lenient on it. So with fruits from outside of Israel, I don't believe we really are concerning ourselves with orla on a regular basis. Fruits from Israel, you do have to concern yourself somewhat with orla, and there are calendars that are put out, depending on the fruit, to make sure it's okay. I remember it came up once with a particular thing, and we have to deal with it. Outside wine, the responsibility of the Mashiach and not the meat and fish. So the outside wine is because they're coming in with a bottle and they're using our kalim, they're using the vessels of, they're using the cups of the place. So that is something that we need to keep track of. The meat and fish is not going to mess up the vessels themselves. So the meat and fish is something that already it's their responsibility, but the wine, anything that's coming into the store that could potentially get into other things is going to be a problem. Many years ago, it was the practice people could even bring, they would even allow non-mavushal wine to come into restaurants. That practice has really been alleviated, as far as I know, in most supervising agencies. Okay? Those were sort of the strict kashrus issues I wanted to touch on as things that we look at as a hashgacha. There were a few things in the chat box, but any questions, comments, observations that people want to raise at this point?
Hi, I have one. Hi, how are you? Thank you
so
much, Rabbi Gruber.
Okay.
Exciting.
Coming, this is easy.
Places that are open on Shabbat. What are the halachos that you have to consider with that?
Okay, so places open on Shabbat has its the specific challenges are especially a place that's not going to have a mashgiach going in regularly. How do we deal with that? So we have a couple of, and then there's sort of outside the realm of kashrus issues that we need to worry about, which I was going to get to. But in terms of the strict kashrus issues, so far we have only given hashkacha to places open on Shabbos, A, that are not Jewish-owned, they have to deal with that issue, or places that really have such a formal process that it's really don't have to, they're not going to change it on Shabbos without us noticing that it's been changed afterwards. So we've given hashkacha to nothing but cakes and to Insomnia Cookies and the Giant Bakery. I think those are our main places off the top of my head that are, that are, and then there's, I guess, some other things as well that are operating on Shabbos. All of those have very formal processes, meaning all their stuff is not really being made on premises. It's all coming from specific ingredients from specific places. They're contractually obligated to get specific things there. And we've monitored it to the point that we're 100% confident they're not changing it specifically for Shabbos. In addition, we have sent people there on Shabbos. I think of those, the Giant Bakery is, I think, the biggest concern from our perspective, just because they, you know, they do use produce there a little bit. They make strawberry things, and that those do need to be checked. So there is a procedure in place. But, you know, how do we know that they don't run out of strawberries and then you know, do some on their own? So there, I actually have had the Giant is at least in our area, Giant is somewhat within walking distance of our shul, and I have had people go there on Shabbos just to check and also just to make it known, like, oh, by the way, you know, we come here on Shabbos too. Don't try to pull anything. Places that have that are much less formal are a little harder to keep track of. Meaning, if it's a mom and pop shop where the owner can kind of just do whatever he wants on a regular basis, so that we'd have to be more nervous about. And for that reason, we haven't really taken on those types of hashgachos. You know, if there's other ways of, you know, creating a type of we would either need to have a mashgiach being able to go in there pretty regularly, or have a very formal process in place. Okay, that's the general Shabbos answer. Now that sort of then leads into the next question, some of the non-kashrus issues that a kashrus organization has to keep track of. So I'll go a little bit out of order and just talk about the Shabbos aspect of that. So number one is, well, there is the Jewish versus non-Jewish ownership. A Jew operating a restaurant on Shabbos, even if he's not religious, is obviously a significant issue. So that we would not be able to get involved in unless the Jew can seriously remove himself from that. So there are ways of, so to speak, selling the business or selling the Shabbos aspect of the business that is done. Some of those processes are very good, and some of those processes are not so serious. So we have some where we've done a pretty serious process to remove the ownership of that over the course of Shabbos and Yontif. Yontif is also throws in a little bit of a wrench into some of these things. So that's one thing to be concerned about. And then the other thing is, is that really, should people really be walking by that kind of store on Shabbos and it being open? So of the places that we've given a heksher to on Shabbos, that are open on Shabbos, so none of them are really where people live. They're not necessarily far away from where people live, but they're not where people are walking on a regular basis on Shabbos. And therefore, we felt that doesn't really take away from the environment that exists in the neighborhood on Shabbos. That's the kind of thing that we would look to the neighborhood Rabbanim and see what they say. And then that also still might depend on what kind of restaurant or what kind of food establishment it is. So there's a big difference between a kosher Jewish establishment, meaning like the Shomer Shabbos Bakery, versus a place like Nothing Bun Cakes. Right? Nothing Bun Cakes is a non-Jewish place that happens to have kosher food and therefore serves our community, as opposed to, to use an example from our side of town, New York Bagels. New York Bagels is a place that is, we're not going to define who their market share is, they really are very much identified with the Jewish community. And they're also three stores down from a shul, right? So to have a place like that being open on Shabbos, so it's felt that would sort of diminishes the even though it's owned by a non-Jew, that sort of diminishes the sanctity of Shabbos in that area. And that would be up to often the Rabbanim in the area, how they feel about that situation. I've heard about places open in other communities when we were looking into some of this. So I called some other Rabbanim. They said that they had a problem in their community that they opened one of these like a donut cookie coffee shop that was open on Shabbos. And people made arrangements on Thursday and Friday to have their donut and coffee ready for them so that they could eat it on their walk to shul. I mean, they'd stop there, get their donut and coffee, and then eat it as they continued walking to shul, and it all coming off their tab from before Shabbos. So that the Ravona put a stop to that, and I believe they took away the hashgacha from that place just because it just didn't work for that community. The Ravona didn't feel that was appropriate to maintain. And then another issue that needs to be thought about by kashrus agencies is that is the type of place. Is the environment a appropriate things that are appropriate for that community? So having TVs there, then there's like having one TV versus being like a sports bar or being a bar or the way the staff is dressed or just the environment that place is in. So that's the kashrus organization has to have their opinion on it. And then also that's something that they should be working with the local rabbanim, especially like the Keystone K. I think we service probably five or six different communities in a way that we are servicing. So what works in Center City, Philadelphia, might not be the same thing that's going to work in the Northeast or Lower Merion, etc. And that's something that we need to monitor. And then the last issue that I have on my list in this area is the issue of what is known as Hasagas Kvul. It's not exactly that, but the issue of unfair competitive practices, meaning if there's a pizza store in a place and someone else wants to open a pizza store, so is the kashrus agency in the right or in the wrong to either give or not to give a hashgacha to the additional pizza store? I still remember, I grew up in Queens, my father is on this call, so I still remember a bagel store opening in Queens, like the second bagel store opening, and it being a big fight, because it's not right there, it's going to put the first one out of business, etc. As a kashrus professional once said to me, I would have loved to be in Borough Park when the second pizza store opened there, right? But at this point, every block has two pizza stores, and it's not going to be, we don't really concern ourselves with that type of competition. So when a community is smaller, so those things need to be taken into account, and they probably are more taken into account. Maybe there are going to be various protections that may be given to certain places especially out of fear that they might lose them or because of perhaps some guarantees that may have been given in the past. So, for example, like a bakery. So a bakery, if somebody comes in as a Shomer Shabbos bakery, so that's a very good thing for the community. So now all of a sudden, the supermarket wants to open up as a bakery. So the Rabbanim and comes to the Rabbanim for a kashrus certification. So I could hear in certain communities the kashrus organization saying, well, wait a second. First of all, we promised this guy, you know, we want to make sure to support this guy who's been already, you know, been loyal to us for several years. And also, if we give the hashgacha to the supermarket and then they put the Shomer Shabbos bakery out of business, so then what's to guarantee that the supermarket's going to stay in the business and then we're going to be left with nothing? So these are cheshbonos not so much for a kashrus organization as much as for the rabbanim of the city. So in many communities, they happen to be the same thing, meaning the rabbanim of the community are also the ones overseeing the kashrus. Here it doesn't quite work that way. There is overlap, of course, but it doesn't quite work that way. But that's something that needs to stay in mind. I'll just share that while Keystone K 15, 20 years ago or so did make these types of deals. I mean, told the place, listen, you can open as a dairy restaurant, but you can't do pizza. Plus, we don't want to put the other. Those kinds of deals were made. We've made it very clear today, certainly to everybody who joins, and it's in everybody's contract, that the Keystone K does not take a stand on these types of issues. If you feel that there is some type of unfair business practice, so here's the phone number for the Philadelphia based in. You can call them, and they can adjudicate it. But as far as we're concerned, if somebody comes to us and wants to open a kosher place, we will certify it, assuming all the other rules, of course, are met. you might advise and say, you know, you might not want to do that. Maybe you should do this. Or, you know, you might try to have them talk to each other and work things out and things like that. But officially speaking, the Community Kashrus of Greater Philadelphia does not take a stand on these types of things. I see. Yes. Could you discuss what changed with Cherry Grill when Keystone K started certifying Cherry Grill? So one thing that changed is the Hashgacha, just who's overseeing it. I mean, what happened with Cherry Grill, I don't think I'm sharing any deep secrets. That is that the OK really didn't want to be overseeing it because the OK was, it was kind of out of their range in terms of what they were able to get to. So they sort of wanted us, they asked us to get involved there, which is good, meaning to just straight up to take something from another place is always a little dicey. But in this case, they came to us and we worked through it. And with the help of the Rabbanim and Cherry Hill, we're able to work on that. In terms of procedural changes, there may have been a couple of small things. I mentioned that thing about adding to the menu. There was, if I recall correctly, there was something about where they were making, how they were doing their fish exactly, that I wanted it to be in a sort of separate oven, which they just took fish off the menu at that point. There are some every organization is going to have their own bug checking procedures or variations of it, so we asked that they, you know, the Mashkichim do our bug checking procedures, so which was a minor change there. But in terms of the general, that's what comes to mind as things that perhaps might have been small changes. Look, any time that restaurants go and they just continue on for a while, so there is a little bit of inertia that sets in. So a new organization comes in, they might point out various things that maybe you might want to seal the package this way instead of that way, and things of that nature. As we're getting close to the end, I just want to share just one thing that you should just be aware of that is out there. Because people often say, "Is this is this organization good? Is it not good? And what exactly does that mean? Good, not good? How do I know?" Things like that. So one thing, there is an organization out there called ACCO. It stands for the Association of Kashrus Organizations. You can look it up online. It's, I think, akokosher.com or something like that. Pretty easily Googleable. And that is sort of the kashrus organization for kashrus organizations in this country, which means that it's overseen mostly by the CRC in Chicago. But the sort of the larger national organizations, OU, Star K, they pool resources to make this happen. And if you're a member of ACCO, so you have agreed to have yourself be under your you've agreed to fulfill various rules. So they have a couple of things out there. Some of them are subject to subject to dispute, and some of them might be subject to long time disputes. But if you're under ACCO, that means you've signed on to the following principles. So the Keystone K is a member of ACCO. They do actually have a list of organizations. You could go to their website and you could see the list of participating organizations. It's not the most organized, because people have asked me, "Hey, we don't see you on the list." So I don't remember exactly how we're listed. Are we Community Kashrus of Greater Philadelphia? Are we Philadelphia Community Kashrus? They don't necessarily list it exactly the way, and it's just an alphabetical order. Keystone K, it's a little hard to find sometimes. But that's a pretty good list to know who could be trusted and who cannot. And just a couple of the rules that are out there, just to give you an example. So number one, we mentioned before that they've all agreed not to follow the Heter Mechira in terms of Shemitah. For instance, hard cheese are subject to the rules of Venus Akum, meaning you see that there's a couple of specific symbols that are on hard cheeses, and say, "Oh, they're no good." That's because they assume like a certain leniency, which most organizations are not going to rely on anymore. Gelatin, meaning all these organizations do not allow regular gelatin into their, what we call non-kosher gelatin, despite the dispute that might be about it, so that won't be allowed. Carmine is an ingredient in certain types of colorings that's made from insects, so there's an argument to be made that that's okay, but all these organizations said no, that's not going to be acceptable. And this has become a very, every time you have a collection like that, it's people have their, people grumble about it. I have my own maybe grumble about it that happened to us at one point, but not for now. But they But ultimately, I think it's a very good thing that we have all these organizations really working together. In fact, I'm on a WhatsApp group with about 160, 170 Kashrus administrators from obviously across the world that are involved. And it's just constantly people putting symbols up. Anybody know this? Anybody know if this is Pasi Israel? Anybody know that this is unlabeled? I remember somebody posted, this is just last week, somebody posted a picture of a frozen broccoli with a star K on it. And the person was like, is this an authorized star K? Because the star K would not give that hechsher. It's not something that in their rules that they would do. And right away, somebody from the star K came on and said, no, what company is that? Send it to me. I'm going to call them right away. So just from that, and all of a sudden, 2 days later, a cautious alert comes out from the Star K that this frozen broccoli, I forgot the brand, I didn't send it out because it's something in the southeast. It's not really something in our area. But right away, they came out with a cautious alert saying it bears an unauthorized Star K symbol and corrective actions are being taken. So, and I would just add at the end that... they also set up guidelines between organizations, meaning for people going into other towns and things like that. I mean, how does that work? And can the OU just show up in Cherry Hill and say, hi, we're opening, you know, it's going to be a restaurant under our hashgacha without the community rabbanim being okay with it? So the ACLU tries to monitor those things. They have various rules that they try to keep in order to maintain shalom and, you know, keep competitive practices out of the way. And I would add that since I've also grew up with all the stories that it's all politics and there's a lot of money and there's all this and that and it's all the same, nobody's really worrying about this. So since coming into this business, I guess I'd say professionally, a year and a half ago, I've been incredibly impressed by the professionalism of the Kashrus organization in America. We could do a whole historical thing about that, how it has evolved in this way, but it is amazing. I mean, you go into factories in the middle of nowhere and everything has a label and everybody knows what the symbols mean and what they are, and when you go into factory in commercial kitchens, the kashrus symbols are much bigger. Like the OUs on 50-pound bag of flowers are like really big because they want people to be able to see it very easily. And it's really amazing. It's really an amazing Kiddush Hashem that happens in this country, which we probably can't imagine having taken place in any other time in history. That just the organization that takes place and cooperation amongst organizations to maintain extremely high level of kashrus, certainly in the industrial world, and as we discussed tonight, in the food service world, things get probably much more challenging than they are in the industrial world. But we really do our best to maintain extremely high standards of kashrus that our community hopefully can be proud of. So I am here. I see. If you feel comfortable, is someone, do you feel more comfortable eating in restaurants or the opposite since starting this position? I'm good. I'm good with the restaurants. If it's under a good organization and the mashgiach is present, I think they really do a very good job. The organizations that I'm familiar with, certainly that have joined with ACLU, are ones you'll see on the CRC list or the Kosher Quest list. Both of those, for the most part, there are some things that slip through the cracks. I'm more enthusiastic of the corporate kashrus world than I was when than before I entered this job. So that's what I guess I have to say. I'll just add, I guess, one more just word about symbols. People are often frustrated. Why can't I just, you know, why can't I know what symbols are good, et cetera, things like that? So when I when I entered the rabbinate, when I got my job in Phoenix, Arizona, I remember there was somebody there was a rabbinic administrator in the OU who learned in the Yeshiva University Beis Medrash. So I went over to him and said, you know, I got this job in Phoenix. I'm moving out there to be the rabbi of this shul. And he said, you know, Mazel Tov. So I said to him, so when do I get the book? He looks at me and says, like what book? I said, I don't know. Whenever, it seems like every rabbi seems to know everything about every hashgacha, right? So when do I get the book, right? I should get entitled to one now. So he just smiled and said, listen, you'll email me all your questions and all your things, and we'll be able to resolve things for you, what you need. So I know there is frustration out there as to why can't there just be an official list that everybody could follow? So that's, you know, hard to do, but certainly your rabbanim and your, and, you know, and certainly us at Keystone K are here to serve those needs that you may have. Okay, Ray Bienfeld, thank you for the opportunity, and I'm here for questions or any other things that come up.
Thank you so much. This is so great. Is there any other questions? I don't want to cut anybody